In Seattle this morning, police are hunting a masked murderer believed to have killed as many as 21 prostitutes in the last 22 months.
Been called the Green River Killer ever since the first bodies, five of them, were pulled from this river. Since then, seven more bodies have been discovered nearby, all those of young prostitutes, according to police. And the number of missing increases steadily. Two were added to the list this week. All the victims work this strip near the Seattle airport, crammed with hotels, motels, and strip joints. They call it the work of the Green River Killer, probably one man who has murdered 13 young women near Seattle. Case unsolved. All deeply troubled sexually. Since 1978, 17 men have been convicted of killing 10 or more people.
Historically, they kill certain types of victims, women, homosexuals, and children.
In Seattle, another grim discovery today.
Explorer scouts have found the remains of another human body buried on a wooded hillside near Seattle.
Police in Washington State believe they found the remains of another victim of the so-called Green River Killer.
Another victim has been identified in the nation's longest list of unsolved murders, the Green River Killings. 37 women have died, 9 missing, all thought to be victims of the same killer.
One lucky break. One individual out there that knows in their heart who's done this and has been reluctant to come forward. This suspect, this individual, has had a remarkable string of luck.
In the early 80s, police in Washington State tied the deaths of 49 young women to the so-called Green River Killer. The killer apparently left the region in 1984, but the number of murders is on the rise again, and police fear the killer may be back.
Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, best-selling author Ian Todd, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we again dive into the Green River and look at the crimes of Gary Leon Ridgway. Before we really get into it, however, a few show notes as well as the normal plugs. Got a couple different interviews that I'm working on getting lined up and recorded, so those will be getting released as soon as they are done. If you would like to follow me on social media, you can find me on Instagram, Facebook, MeWe, and YouTube. Just search for Ian Totten, author. On Facebook, there is a Deathcast group that's associated with my author page, which has been exploding in numbers over the last few weeks. So thank you to everyone who has joined the group. I will be back on Facebook shortly, currently in the middle of a 90-day stint for posting things that go against their community standards, but, you know, that's how it is. All these social media sites have these ridiculous standards. If you would like to follow me on Twitter, just search for Corpse Creek. You can also find me at my official website, corpsecreekpublishing.com. There you can sign up for the newsletter. Soon you'll be able to purchase autographed copies of my novels through that site, as well as help the show out by clicking on the donate button. If you'd like to buy me a cup of coffee or a pack of smokes, just click on the donate button. Any amount is appreciated, and nothing is too small. If you enjoy the show but cannot give a financial donation, another way you can help out the show is by liking and subscribing on your favorite podcast app, leaving a 5-star review, and sharing the show on social media. To those of you who have done so, I appreciate it and thank you. Alright, now get yourself something to drink, find a comfy chair, sit back, relax, close your eyes. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go to the Green River. So we're taking our fourth look at the Green River killings. Over the past three episodes, we've looked extensively at the victims of Gary Ridgway, naming them, going over various bits of their lives, and seeing the similarities between so many of the young women that he murdered. While touching briefly on the actual investigation into who was committing these crimes. But we really haven't looked extensively at the investigation or at the perpetrator. So that's what we're going to be doing this week. The reason I've done it this way is if we were to cover everything chronologically, including the victims, as well as really getting into the investigation, I'd have an hour and a half episodes coming out, which is a lot of work, especially when you consider that this show is done as a part-time gig, and it's really more me sharing with you something that I find fascinating, which is true crime. When the first five bodies were pulled from the Green River in the late summer, early fall of 1982, the police in Kings County were very quick to realize that they had most probably a serial killer on their hands. From what I have seen and read, they did not make this information public right away, probably because the area was still healing from the wounds Ted Bundy had inflicted upon it. But they also did not want to create a panic. But fairly quickly, it was out of their control. The public learned that there was an individual stalking the prostitutes who worked on the SeaTac Strip. And the longer they investigated the series of murders, the more pressure was put on them by both the local and then eventually national media, as well as the people who lived in the area. Some people didn't care that the killer was taking the lives of prostitutes, while there were others who saw these women for what they were, human beings, and actually took up their cause, protesting the police's inability to capture this killer. Investigators brought in outside help from the FBI, who was really there to act in an advisory capacity. Last week, I went over the first profile that John Douglas gave of the killer and how off the mark it was on many aspects of the individual that they should have been looking for, as well as reasons why it was off the mark, and also discussed how, even though television and movies really likes to play up criminal profiling as an exact science, even those men who practice it and conceived of the idea have admitted that it is more of an art form, and they're pretty much taking shots in the dark based upon similar crimes they have encountered in the past and the perpetrators of those crimes. As the killings continued on, many of the investigators got very emotionally and mentally involved in the case, which goes against a lot of what you see and read concerning cops who are, you know, kind of heartless bullies who are only in the job for the power trip that it gives them. The cops working the Green River Task Force, least from everything I have seen and read, were dedicated to stopping these murders and protecting the young women that this killer was preying on. And I think a big portion of that has to do with the fact that many of these victims were so young and inexperienced in life and doing the only thing that they could in order to support themselves, given the hand that life had dealt them up to that point. A lot of these investigators were husbands and fathers, and a number of them have gone on the record as stating that they saw their own daughters reflected back at them in many of these victims. So the crimes really took a toll on those who were working them. Especially as 1984 drew on and more dump sites were discovered. In fall of 1984, however, something unusual happened. Investigators with the task force received a letter from a Florida state prison from a convicted murderer they knew all too well. That would be one Theodore Robert Bundy, also known as Ted Bundy. Bundy was the perpetrator of the Ted murders, which had plagued Washington, Oregon, Utah, and a number of other states, culminating in his arrest and trial for the attempted murder and abduction of one young woman, after which he escaped from jail and fled the area before eventually continuing his murder spree in the state of Florida, the last of which was a 12-year-old girl named Kimberly Leach, whom he had raped and then murdered by forcing her face into a puddle of mud, which she unfortunately drowned in. So for those who have read my last novel, The Throwaway Girls of Olympia, and were disturbed by that particular scene in the book, now you know where I got it. So Ted Bundy was not a good guy. He was a very charismatic, good-looking, manipulative individual. However, when he reached out to the members of the Green River Task Force and offered to help solve the crimes, they initially agreed to speak with him in the hopes that he would say something that would allow them to charge him in the state of Washington. Another serial killer who reached out around this time was a Canadian man by the name of Clifford Olson. Although, to the best of my knowledge, the task force never took Olson up on his offer. Bundy, however, did offer some unique insights into the man that he called the River Man. One of those was that he said the killer was probably returning to the sites where he dropped the bodies in order to have sexual relations with them. Bundy also stated that if they should find a new dump site, investigators should keep that information from the press and stake the area out in the hopes that the killer would return to spend time with one of his victims. Bundy also stated that the killer was probably following the police and the media's coverage of the case, and that he felt no remorse for the things he did and was enjoying the media attention that he was getting. All of these things would later be proven to be true. However, at the time, although the police did suspect that the killer was in fact following the story as it unfolded in the paper, they largely dismissed the information that Bundy gave them, feeling that most of what he was saying were thinly veiled confessions to his own crimes, and the only reason he had offered to help was because he was jealous of the Green River Killer, and to see him getting so much attention in an area where he himself, just a few years beforehand, was in all the headlines, affected Bundy's ego. And there is some truth to that. Bundy did have a very large ego, and he used it time and again in an effort to try and stay his execution by offering insights to various cases, as well as offering to confess to other crimes he had committed that the police were unaware of. There were other little nuances about the killer that Bundy offered, such as the fact that he had a very strong libido and would need, you know, a pretty consistent amount of sexual stimulation, hence the number of victims, but that he was also probably somewhat a loner who felt inadequate in most aspects in his life. Again, this was stuff that the police largely ignored because they felt that Ted was simply stroking his own ego. So while all of this is going on, the bodies are being discovered, the police are working round the clock to try and figure out who is committing these murders, the actual killer was going through some life changes that the police were unaware of, which we will get to shortly. The police did note that the amount of girls who were disappearing decreased dramatically, as well as the number of new victims being added to the list. As 1984 ended and 85 began, however, they would later learn that the killer had not actually stopped his murderous ways or moved from the area, died, or been in prison. He had simply switched his hunting ground for unspecified reasons, probably to continue avoiding detection. And I say this because it is known that Ridgway operated in the neighboring state of Oregon, taking at least 4 women's lives in that area. But for the most part, it seems as though he had stopped killing, which, as I discussed in other episodes, I do not believe actually took place. I just think Ridgway never admitted to any further murders, because to do so after his plea bargain later in life would have ensured the death penalty for him. As previously discussed during the investigation, Ridgway came to the police's attention a number of times throughout the 1980s and into the 1990s. The first time he was arrested in 1982 for soliciting prostitutes, and although I may be mistaken on this, I'm fairly certain he was arrested again later on for soliciting prostitutes, which is when they gave him the lie detector test, which he was able to pass. They also had the disappearance in 1983, where the family members of the missing girl led the police to his front door. So he was on the police's radar. However, Ridgway was a fairly unassuming-looking man, and there was such a deluge of information coming into the task force that they really couldn't stop and focus on one suspect for any considerable period of time. But as the years wore on, Ridgway was one of those suspects who kept coming up in their investigation. In 1986, John Douglas again threw his hat into the ring in terms of the Green River Killer by penning another profile of the man he believed to be responsible. this profile was similar to the first in that he believed that the killer was a larger man who was in extremely good physical shape and outdoorsman who smoked, drank, and was fairly messy in his private life. One thing that should be noted in when it concerns Ridgway, however, is that he did not fit the general consensus in that Ridgway had a steady line of employment for years, and detectives believed that the individual who was committing these murders would not have a job with steady hours, as the amount of time it would take this individual to pick out his victims, kill them, dispose of the bodies, etc., etc., would be too great. And that is because back then, they really did not understand the way serial killers operated. I mean, they still don't know to 100% certainty how they operate, but back in the mid to late 80s, they did not understand that an individual like this, killing isn't a hobby to them. It is what many of them see to be their life's work and their careers. The police ended up zeroing in on a suspect in 1986 who was a fur trapper, and eventually it would be found that this man was not the killer, but there was a considerable amount of time when that was the only viable suspect the police were looking at, and it did lead to lawsuits being exchanged between media outlets who targeted this man once they learned of his existence. Over the ensuing years after the killings initially stopped in 1984, there were a number of different killers who came to light operating in the same area as Gary Ridgway. Unfortunately, when these individuals were found, there was a lot of speculation by both the media and the police that they might, in fact, have caught the Green River Killer. However, they had not. And as time wore on, the police kept returning again and again to one single suspect. And they were aided in this by use of a computer that had been acquired for the task force with the specific intent of collating all of the data and tips and suspects that they had received over the years. Some of the information that came back to them through this computer were that this individual, who was a fairly mild-mannered and seemingly meek individual, had been arrested in the presence of a young woman by the name of Kelly K. McGinnis. He was also spoken to after a prostitute allegedly bit his genitals during oral sex, and he began to strangle the woman. Later, he had been questioned at a fast food restaurant right around the area where many of the disappearances had taken place. He was known to drive older pickup trucks that in many cases matched descriptions of those seen with the missing women prior to their disappearances. This is, of course, Gary Leon Ridgway, who I have referenced throughout this series. The police became so interested in him during 1986 and 87 that they actually began performing surveillance on the 37-year-old married man who worked as a truck painter at the Kenworth plant. On April 8, 1987, police executed a number of search warrants at both his home, his locker at the Kenworth plant where he was currently employed, and three vehicles that he had available to him. They brought Ridgway into the Police Department took hair samples, and they also took the unusual step of taking a mouth sample from him. This naturally led to people at work joking that he was the killer, and he gained the nickname of Green River Gary. However, Ridgway was cleared as a suspect at this time, and not long afterwards is when the first killer who was suspected as possibly being the Green River Killer was apprehended. And that was Dayton Leroy Rogers. He was a auto repairman who lived roughly 24 miles south of Portland. And he was known among the local prostitutes as being something of a weirdo who had a bondage and foot fetish. He was apprehended after a number of witnesses saw him assaulting a woman in a Denny's parking lot, and one witness had the foresight to write down the man's license plate number, which led them back to Rogers' home. Unlike the Green River Killer, however, Rogers was known to mutilate his victims, specifically their feet, cutting them off and engaging in sex acts with the open stumps. So the initial media frenzy over this man's arrest was tamped down when the nature of his crimes came out. The task force, however, did not give up on looking at Gary Ridgway. Even years later, when Robert Lee Gates was arrested for the murder of close to 20 prostitutes, and his name was bandied about as a possible suspect in the Green River murders, the detective still kept looking in on Ridgway from time to time in an attempt to tie him to the murders. So, who was Gary Leon Ridgway? He was born February 18, 1949 in Salt Lake City, Utah, the second son of Mary and Thomas Ridgway's three sons. And it's been said that Ridgway's mother was very domineering and combative, and that Ridgway often saw violent feuds erupt between both of his parents. It was also learned that his father was a bus driver who oftentimes complained about encountering sex workers along his daily route. He was diagnosed as having dyslexia and was fairly unimpressive as a student. Ridgway was also a frequent bedwetter well out of adolescence, and his mother eventually forced him to help strip the bed, after which she would make him go sit into a tub of cold water while she washed his legs, rear end, and genital area. From everything I have read about Ridgway, it seems that he was really a sad and pathetic little boy who was looked on by his classmates and those in the various neighborhoods around where the family lived as being something of an odd individual. And not odd in a "this kid is dangerous" or anything like that, just in that he didn't seem to fit in any place at all. Part of this may have been due to the fact that the family was constantly moving. And there's also a story out there that purports his father would state that he had nearly drowned when he was fairly young, something Ridgway himself has stated, although he has also said he doesn't remember this, only that his father used to tell him about it. He was also bullied quite a bit in school because Ridgway was a smaller than normal kid. And that, coupled with all of his other issues, really drove him further and further away from people. But not in the way that most people think, you know, when they think of a serial killer, they think of a loner. It just seemed to further alienate him from those around him. Ridgway would interact with other people, but it was like he wasn't really there in all of his interactions. I've seen interviews with him and read letters that he has written to other people, and a lot of what he says and does is more along the lines of mimicking what an actual person does than it is his real thoughts or emotions. One thing of note concerning his home life and the bullying is that apparently Ridgway's father told him that he would beat the boy himself if he came home again having been beaten by one of the local bullies. This was when they lived in Idaho, and he afterwards taught young Gary how to fight, and Gary took immense pleasure in the day he finally stood up to this other boy and held him down and pummeled him, knowing that his father was watching and was pleased with what he was seeing. This seems to have been something of a turning point in Ridgway's life, as from this point onwards, he began to fantasize quite a bit about violence, and he also began setting fires. So, right off the bat, we have this young boy, Gary Ridgway, showing what three of the McDonald Triad, which are the things that they police and law enforcement look for when they are investigating serial murders, the things they look for in individuals. Those are arson, cruelty to animals, and uncontrollable bedwetting. Thus far, Ridgway has two of them in the fire starting and the bedwetting. He also suffered from something that many similar individuals do, which is this empty feeling that they have inside of them that nothing seems to fill. Many of them discover fairly quickly that acts of violence fills this void that's inside of them, and Ridgway was no exception to that rule. Whether it was through fighting with other kids or petty acts of vandalism like busting out windows on a school or on, you know, cars that had been left sitting on the side of the street to setting fires, this seemed to fill the void that Ridgway felt inside of him. Another thing that seemed to fill this void was his mother's washings of him when he wet the bed. According to Ridgway, he felt anger and shame when she did it, but it also sexually excited him. And according to Ridgway, this was really when he began fantasizing about sex, round about the age of 13. It was also around this time that Ridgway began peeping through windows in people's houses in an attempt to try and see, you know, women in a state of undress, all the while fantasizing about being this suave, debonair individual who was able to easily talk to and convince these women that he was seeing inside of the houses to have sex with him. It is known that at one point he was able to convince a younger girl cousin of his to go out into the woods with him, where he fondled her, and apparently he got in trouble for this. But that did not stop Ridgway from, you know, casually brushing his crotch against the girl when he was passing her in the hall, or accidentally rubbing a hand across her chest or buttocks. And it was around about this time, you know, early puberty, that Ridgway began acting out the violent fantasies that were inside of his head. He picked up the third of the McDonald Triad and began killing animals, starting off with birds before moving his way up to cats. This is from a recollection of Ridgway. He had always felt a burning rage inside of him, much having to do with his home life, but also having to do with his inability to succeed in school where other kids seemed to do well. He had stayed back a number of years. I believe at this time, age 14 or so, he was actually still in the sixth grade. When he was sitting at the house and one of the family cats came up to him, and he decided he was mad at the cat, so he picked it up and put it inside a cooler and locked it inside. And when he returned the next day, the cat was dead. And this was another turning point for Ridgway, because this act of killing the cat, as opposed to the birds, made him feel strong and important, as opposed to how he had felt prior to that, which was weak and ineffectual. Around this period of time as well, I believe he was about 16, Ridgway began carrying a knife on him. And as the story goes, he was standing there one day when a little boy walked by, and without even thinking about it, grabbed the boy, dragged him into the bushes, and stabbed him. And this, coupled with the cat murder, I suspect is what really began to give Ridgway this idea of invulnerability, because, much like with the cat, he did not get in trouble for what he had done to the boy. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, this young man has never been identified, although he did live through the assault. He also found himself fascinated with death more and more as his teenage years wore on, with one account stating that a woman had been murdered who lived on their block. She had gone out one summer night wearing only her bathrobe and been strangled by the cord around the bathrobe. And this excited Ridgway, who spoke about it quite a bit with his father. And apparently he was wondering how the individual who had done it felt, and whether or not the man had had sex with the woman before he killed her. So you can see, from early childhood up into his teen years, this evolution in Gary Ridgway's personality, how his psychosis, for want of a better word, began to form, first with the bedwetting and then the rage he felt at being unable to perform academically at school or fit in any of the various places his family moved to, then to his sexual excitement at being washed by his mother and keeping in on people, before finally manifesting itself in acts of violence and petty larceny. For Ridgway, he eventually did have sex with a woman before he graduated from high school, although by his own admission, it was really nothing to write home about, and he and this young woman, who was a few years older than he was, never consummated their relationship again after that. He also began to show an aptitude for mechanical things as well as hiking and fishing. This ties into the profiles that were done of the killer, in that he was an avid outdoorsman. Well, in Gary Ridgway's case, this did come to be correct. He was also an extremely studious and punctual employee who was noted as being a hard worker. Ridgway had various jobs around Seattle where his family eventually settled. So at least he had a strong work ethic. You gotta give the guy that. When he graduated high school at the age of 20, the Vietnam War was still raging, and Ridgway ended up enlisting in the United States Navy. Shortly before this, however, he ended up getting married to a woman by the name of Heather, who has been noted as being his first steady girlfriend. This was in August of 1970. This woman noted that Ridgway at this point had a nearly insatiable sexual appetite and would request sex from her a number of times a day. And their marriage seemed to be somewhat happy at first. When Ridgway shipped off overseas, however, the marriage quickly soured as they were both fairly young and immature, and accusations of infidelity were thrown around from both sides. This is not something that is unique to the case of Gary Ridgway, however. As I stated months back in another episode, I was in the service myself, and I saw this kind of stuff happen quite often, where someone who was really young would get married to their high school sweetheart or whatever, or just a girl they happened to meet after getting into the service, and once deployment comes, all bets are off. He's cheating on her, she's cheating on him, they're fighting back and forth with each other. And that's when I was in that we used to jokingly refer to the Navy as the marriage killer, because so many people ended up in divorces when they came back from a deployment. And this is what happened with the Ridgways. She began to see other people while he was overseas, while Gary began to frequent prostitutes in the ports that they would visit. And during one of these port visits, he ended up contracting a venereal disease from one of these women, which many speculate is where his hatred of prostitutes came from, in that he loved to partake of their services, but he still carried that grudge from catching this disease. Although Ridgway stated that this was not the case, he did not feel rage stemming from this particular incident, and he thought back fondly on these prostitutes. Returning from his deployment, Ridgway went back to Seattle, and his wife followed, although very quickly the marriage ended and she left. Ridgway would label her as a quote-unquote whore after this, and he very quickly ended up going to places where he knew that he could meet women in an attempt to forge a relationship with one of them. And it seems that Ridgway went through a succession of different girlfriends while also frequenting the prostitutes who inhabited the area where he lived, known as the Loop in Renton. And not too terribly long after his first marriage ended, he ended up meeting another woman who gave Gary the attention that he craved. He also began to work as a truck painter at the Kenworth plant. This woman that Gary had met was named Marcia, and they ended up marrying in 1973. This marriage produced one child, a son they named Matthew. According to those who knew the young couple at this point, Ridgway went to great pains to make himself seem more outgoing than he actually was, at oftentimes telling fairly inappropriate jokes. One of his favorites being that he had married a thin blonde woman and that didn't work out, so this time he had decided to marry a fat brunette to see if it would change his look. Ridgway continued to frequent prostitutes during this marriage, and eventually his wife had some type of surgery, and she ended up losing a tremendous amount of weight. This led the woman to begin to receive attention from men, something that had never happened beforehand. And as often happens in these types of situations, Ridgway's wife ended up stepping out of the marriage on him. And personally, I believe this infidelity on his first and second wife's parts is what really cemented his rage at women, and would eventually lead him to begin killing them. And I don't want that to sound like an excuse for what Ridgway did. He himself was fairly promiscuous, sleeping with God knows how many prostitutes behind his wives' backs. But in his mind, it was okay for him to commit these infidelities because their religion stated that the wife was to stay home and be a dutiful spouse. And that's something that doesn't get talked about enough with Ridgway. At some point in the 70s, he got involved in a church which, from all sources, was a fairly fire and brimstone type of place. And he was heavily involved in this church, holding various positions inside of it throughout the years. And this religion really helped to enforce Ridgway's worldview as it pertained to women. Although, as I've already spoken about, he really saw women as a means to an end, which is to have sex with, control, and dominate. Eventually, he ended up divorcing his second wife in 1981. And with this second divorce, Ridgway's sexual escapades with prostitutes really took off. Later, after his eventual arrest, people would state that Ridgway continually railed against the presence of prostitutes in the neighborhood that he was living in, despite the fact that he was so frequent of a customer to them. To show how much his sex drive controlled him, Ridgway, who had joint custody of their son, ended up joining an organization called Parents Without Partners, and he had numerous liaison with various women who were a part of this group, even living with a number of them for periods of time. Ridgway often brought his young son to the various events this organization held, dangling the young boy out there as something of a carrot in order to entice the various women who were part of it to interact with him. Ridgway ended up meeting a woman by the name of Judith in the Parents Without Partners group, and the two of them were eventually married in 1988. Because they held so many similar interests, and because Ridgway was so active in both his church and in this organization, it's speculated that these upheavals in his personal life are what really led to the murders taping off in 1984 and stopping by the end of that year. However, it should be noted that Ridgway is still known to have frequented prostitutes during this period of time. If you see pictures of Ridgway from the mid to late 80s onwards, you can see a man who seems to have had a rough start in life, has had two failed marriages, but then in Judith has found, you know, his partner. And you can see as they built their life together how much the two of them accomplished. However, Judith was unaware that her husband was going out and committing these crimes and frequenting prostitutes. Oftentimes he would leave for work much earlier than he was supposed to, claiming that he was going in to get overtime, or he would return later than he was supposed to, stating that they had needed him to stay and work. Which, as anyone who has a family knows, if overtime is offered more times than not, you're going to accept it. And I have seen nothing that says that he was not, in fact, working overtime during some of these periods, but the majority of what was going on is that he was going out and picking up girls, taking them someplace, and having sex with them, and either releasing them or killing them. One thing that I really haven't gotten into too much concerning Ridgway is he was a bit of an exhibitionist. He liked having sex outdoors in areas where it was likely that he and his partner of the moment might be discovered. Ridgway's third wife also said that he was a hardworking, honest, and dependable individual who had no problem opening up their home to her daughter and her husband and child while they were looking for a new place to live. So you can see that Gary is really going through great pains to try and show masks of normality, which is one of the things that made it so hard for the detectives hunting him to figure out that he was the killer. Because he had such an active social life, and because he was usually in a steady relationship or married and had a steady home, a steady job, he did not fall within the parameters of the individual that they believed that they were looking for. And again, they didn't have a crystal ball that they could see every moment of this man's waking hours, or where they were able to look back from the future and see just what exactly was going on in his life. Serial killers of Ridgway's type, they build up this mask of normality. They build up these lives around them that, to a curious examination, seem to be perfectly normal, despite the odd comments that they may say or the peculiarities in their life or their interests. So unless people close to them really, really have a concern that they are, you know, in fact responsible for some of these crimes that the police are investigating, it is very easy for them to slip underneath the radar as a odd but quote-unquote normal functioning member of society. So now you have a bit of a background on who Gary Ridgway was. I am going to leave off here for this episode, and the next episode will be the last in this series, where we'll cover the 1990s into the 2000s as the investigation continues, doesn't get a lot of media coverage, and the killer is known to have started committing murders again. That is assuming he ever stopped, which I really, really do not believe he did. So, until next week, I am your host, best-selling author Ian Totten. The Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Stay safe, and stay morbid.